Previously on The Storyteller, Naked Villainy, the defence throws insults at the Crown's case for murder.
This is very much their last hurrah, and they are throwing the kitchen sink at it, whether it's relevant or whether it's not.
Claims of no proof that Kit Harrison was at the murder scene.
There is not a single shred of evidence that places Dr. Christopher Harrison in the Allen Street flat that night.
And not good enough, the Crown have failed in the eyes of the defence.
The Crown have to close is that yawning chasm.
It's taken 45 years to bring a killer to court. And for the first time in UK history, you'll hear the full murder trial and witness justice being done. It was a brutal murder of a brilliant woman who was a rising star in genetic research.
It would now be almost like a script from Morse. The investigators swarming over the dreaming spires of university land.
There was kind of palpable feeling of evil in the air.
I was told it was just a mass of blood in here.
2 decades on from confronting evil.
Did you kill your ex-wife, Brenda Page?
Evil is being confronted by the law.
Did you kill her?
No.
She knew it was coming.
He said he was going to kill her.
If he killed her, he would do it so that nobody would know.
Will his true nature be unmasked?
Are you familiar with the tale of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde?
And can Brenda's own words help secure her killer's fate?
A letter of a death foretold.
This is The Storyteller, Naked Villainy, written, produced and edited by me, Isla Traquair. The closing speech marathon was almost over, and the intensity of the attack on the Crown witnesses and the dismissal of much of the evidence was causing murmurs in the press bench. The Crown case had seemed very strong, with the analogy of multiple strands strengthening the cable. But it was beginning to feel like some of the strands were being chopped. We'll rejoin as Defence KC Brian McConaughey continued his witness-by-witness teardown.
Sarah McIntyre was a witness who Dr. Harrison went to get her to contact Brenda Page due to the fact there was an interdict outstanding. I think it was either 1977 or 1978. Now, when contact was made, there was no deception on the part of either Dr. Harrison or Sarah McIntyre, in the sense that when she did decide to phone Brenda Page, she told Brenda Page that it was Chris Harrison who wanted to speak to her. So when she agrees to speak to him, she knows it's him. When she agrees to meet with him, she knows it's him. Now, he says it was a good meeting. She apparently says not so much. But this was another witness who'd been told all sorts of things by Brenda Page about her life with Kit Harrison. And she was, you may think, very surprised when hearing about the fact that he'd been invited round and had a picnic in her garden in May of 1978. And no doubt about any other contact at that particular time.
He omitted the incident involving Kit at the party which Professor McIntyre witnessed, and his subsequent apology and explanation to her that he feared he would become aggressive. He also left out the fact the professor felt forced to call Brenda.
I mentioned the taxi driver earlier on, James Cook. Now, what he apparently sees is that at 12:30 there is a car there. He didn't even, I think, give you a colour. Same kind of car. Don't think he gave you a colour, didn't give you a registration. But there's nobody about and there's nobody in the car. But again, how does that fit with the evidence of Heather Lindsay? How does it fit with the evidence of Mr. Burt? What is the significance of that evidence? Well, you're entitled to ask yourselves, in respect of any piece of evidence, what does it mean and how do we put it in context? How many mini clubmans existed in 1978? How long had they been manufactured? And these sort of issues become more relevant with every passing piece of evidence about the car. Jessie Watt. She was another close friend. Another one to whom she made the, if it looks like suicide, it won't be comment. She was also the witness who, as we discovered going through her evidence, who was on the trip to Vienna. The trip to Vienna was in 1978. But it so happened Jessie Watt had forgotten all of the arrangements about that. She didn't remember what the arrangements were. And of course that happens. It's 45 years ago. But the good thing is, we had her statement, which she could look at and refresh her memory. And that applies really to all of the witnesses. They could all look at their statements and refresh their memory about what they'd said at the time. Dr. Harrison, of course, doesn't have that luxury. So far as Jessie Watt was concerned, she didn't see any injuries. It was all totally dependent upon the narrative she was given by Brenda Page. The narrative, which is somehow blurred at the very least by the fact that for the trip to Vienna, Dr. Harrison, Dr. Page, Jessie Watt and her husband all meet in London and then all travel to Vienna together. They all stay in the same hotel. And indeed, Dr. Harrison and Dr. Page are sharing a room. It doesn't fit with the picture that Dr. Page wants people to believe. There was an odd example provided by Jessie Watt about Dr. Page's attitude to Dr. Harrison. When on, I think it was her birthday or something of that nature, he delivered bread. And she said, "Don't eat that, it'll be poisoned." Now, on any view, that's a bizarre behaviour. Despite Dr. Watt's views, it sounded awfully like paranoia, or perhaps more an example of drama, hysteria on the part of Brenda Page. The Vienna trip, and subsequent to that, the party that she took Kit Harrison to because she'd split up with George Narrow. How does any of that fit in with the picture which she's attempting to paint? She also spoke about the escort agency and how, as far as she was concerned, it was perfectly respectable. All that Brenda was looking for were the bright lights. She didn't think there was any sexual relationships involved in it. Once again, she was wrong.
There was a break for lunch, and I was glad of it to let my anger lessen. Paranoia, hysteria, drama, victim blaming at its finest. Shame, blame, gaslight. And it was about to get worse.
The escort agency evidence in my submission is important. Now, not in any way, shape or form to seek to blacken character or anything of that nature. Whether it's 1978 or 2023, what a man or woman consensually chooses to do is entirely up to them. And as the Leonard Advocate Depute correctly said, this is not a court of morals. But what you have is agreed, undisputed evidence, and it calls into question every single thing that Brenda Page ever told anyone about the work that she did. In the second joint minute, you discover that Brenda Page had been working as an escort since the 1st of November 1976, so not that long after the separation. And she was engaged in providing such services for a period of approximately 2 years, acting as an escort roughly once a fortnight. What you find out as well is that in 1977, on the 19th, 20th and 24th of August, she met a man called Stephen Smith. When she met him, she took her own car, something which she advised her friends and colleagues she didn't do. She took him to her home, something she advised her friends and colleagues she didn't do. And she had sex with him. Now, the whole point, so far as some of the people who gave evidence about what she told them in relation to these matters, was how security and safety conscious she was in carrying out this work. And you didn't want clients to know where you lived. Well, that does not seem to have been the truth of the matter. 14th of September 1977, having met a man called Nicholas Ashton on the 14th of September, driving her own vehicle to and from that appointment, she then meets him at his hotel on the 15th of September and has sex with him. On the 13th of July, as you know, Capital Escorts get a call seeking to book two escorts for somebody's men called Archibald Cormack and Jack Welsh. They're unable to arrange two, and Brenda Page agrees to go alone and attends there at 10 o'clock at night. Now, everything which she proclaims about this being just for the bright lights, just for money, that she always gets taxis there and back, all these things that were emphasised by the people to whom she told her tale are demonstrated to be false.
This was to be expected. So on one hand, everyone is entitled to do what they want as long as it's consensual. But then he criticised Brenda for doing exactly that. As I mentioned before, detectives told me 2 decades ago that if she felt a romantic connection with a client, then she'd met up with them separately. And as a single woman in her early 30s, why on earth wouldn't she be entitled to have sex on what would now be classed as a date, having originally met through the agency? And let's remember, the two men that she had dinner with that night at the treetops, and any other client she'd met previously, were thoroughly investigated and ruled out.
There was a witness, Mrs. Hood, now deceased, who gave evidence through the officer who took her statement. And in my submission to you, there were parts of that statement which, kind of in a nutshell, set out the position. She said, amongst other things, they were married in late 1972 or early 1973. I can't quite remember. And they lived together quite happily at first. But after only about 6 months or so, Brenda started telling me that Chris was hitting her and things like that. Brenda said it was for no reason whatsoever. But I only heard her side of the story. You could add that comment into the statement of virtually every witness who gave evidence in this case. Anyway, I lived directly above them, and I never heard anything like a fight or assault taking place at any time. I didn't see any injuries on Brenda either. She was the upstairs neighbour in West Savile Terrace in Edinburgh. But in my submission, kind of just sums it up that Brenda Page said things, people listened, people heard them, but they only ever had her side of the story.
A reminder, Brenda went to hospital during this time, so just because the neighbour didn't see her being assaulted doesn't mean it didn't happen. Next, he referred to the statement by Thomas Wood and questioned the logic of the Crown linking Brenda's claim she protected her head during Kit's assaults and the defence injuries to her hands in the post-mortem.
I'm not sure what the logic of that position is. Is it being suggested that if she were being attacked by someone who was not Christopher Harrison, she would not seek to protect her head and would not therefore sustain the defensive injuries? It doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. I spoke about a witness, Raymond Chan, earlier on. Raymond Chan is an interesting witness. If for no other reason than the desperate and failed attempts by the advocate depute to try and get him to adopt a statement he made 42 years after the event, rather than be content with the statement he made the next day. Why? Because the timings didn't suit the advocate depute. The timings made the treetop sighting of a motor vehicle at 12:30 by the taxi driver pointless. Because according to Raymond Chan, he left the property at 12:30, having been there for 10 minutes. And at 12:30, whatever Raymond Chan saw or heard, according to the taxi driver, what the Crown want you to accept is the taxi driver saw Dr. Harrison's car. But at 12:30, when Raymond Chan leaves the area, if that's right, then his car is lying unattended at the Treetops Hotel. The Crown cross-examined Dr. Harrison about Crown Production 49, and the learned advocate depute read to you from this letter in his address, I think, one sentence. The sentence that says that causes those rages of which you are afraid. In my submission, ladies and gentlemen, you have to put that letter and that comment into context. If what is being suggested is that that letter, dated the 11th of February 1978, somehow or other establishes or proves violence so far as Dr. Harrison is concerned, then in my submission, that is stretching things beyond breaking point. The letter is all about his own inadequacies. He talks about the lack of confidence and security that he has. He talks about until being able to unbottle, he shall never be a whole person. I know that, but that is what being shy being ashamed, being afraid, and feeling insecure produce a frosty introversion. It's all about him being introverted. He talks about, in the same passage that the Learned Advocate Depute quotes from, "It is bottling things up that causes my acute inner griefs, and it is that conflict between the need to tell and be healed in a lover's arms and the shame which makes me keep my failures to myself that causes those rages of which you are afraid. Soothed and whole, I should be very even-tempered. I believe my real nature is as sunny as yours, but mine has been soured by being locked up like a bull in a small backyard for far too many years." The entire letter is about his crippling shyness, his inferiority complex, everything he talks about, internal conflict. Dr. Harrison, in his evidence, said that rage should be read as internal rage as well. And in the full context of that letter, that makes an awful lot of sense. Taking one piece of the letter, one part of a sentence completely out of context, tells you nothing.
Stepping away from the trial for just a moment so I can briefly tell you about the episode sponsor and how you could be cashing in by running your own business. That's the sweet sound you could be hearing making a sale on Shopify. What is Shopify? Well, you already have been using it without even knowing as a customer. But you could be the one making the sales by setting up your own online business and using Shopify to do all the hard work for you. It's an all-in-one platform to start, run, and grow your business. My friends who use it swear by it and say it's made things so simple to customize their online shop, connect with new customers, maintain relationships, and grow their business. And that's why every minute, new sellers around the world are taking the leap and revolutionizing their business and making their first sales on Shopify. It's a single dashboard. You can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. And Shopify makes getting paid so simple by instantly accepting all payment types. So whether you're selling art, home gifts, serums, succulents, paintings or pottery, Shopify removes the stress and covers all your sales channels. You can even sell across social media like Facebook, Instagram and TikTok. It also removes the guesswork with built-in tools that help you create, execute and analyse your online marketing campaigns. And here's the best bit. You don't need to learn how to code or design. It's done for you. And there's award-winning help on hand with an extensive business course library. So no matter how big or small you want to grow, Shopify will be there to empower you with the confidence and control to take your business to the next level. So if this sounds good to you, you can sign up for a £1 per month trial using the special code. It's shopify.co.uk/storyteller. That's shopify.co.uk/storyteller. And you'll get a whole month for a trial for just £1. That's shopify.co.uk/storyteller. Now let's return to the courtroom. If his interpretation of the letter was accurate, it's interesting that no one who knew Kit described him as being shy and introverted. Why would Brenda be afraid of rages if they were internal? Mr. McConaughey accused the Crown of stretching it to breaking point, but I think the jury may have viewed Kit's interpretation as the stretch. Remember in the police interview and in the witness box, he said there was no insecurity professionally. Brenda and he were living separate lives. That letter does not sound like it's from someone who has moved on.
Forensics, ladies and gentlemen. Forensics might or might not be important in this case. You first of all had Eric Jensen. Now, I don't know what you made of him. Sherlock Holmes, Hercule Poirot and CSI all rolled into one. An expert, you may think, according to himself, in just about everything, including his Montrose Academy Prize for DIY. He's a man who was, at the time, apparently familiar in relation to cross-contamination, yet prepared, it would seem, at the time, to potentially contaminate each and every part of the crime scene. By the end, in fact, not even by the end, in the middle of cross-examination, it became apparent that he wasn't even able to tell you whether he wore gloves at the time. He is touching an untold number of items within that house that are taken possession of, potentially without gloves. Touching one item, putting it in a bag, touching another item, putting it in a bag. The kind of thing that simply would not be permitted to take place these days. The only protection, so far as he was concerned, was the wearing of a white lab coat. The rest of it, he's wearing his own trousers, his own shoes. The CID officers who are present have nothing to protect them, nothing at all. Before he examines the car belonging to Dr. Harrison, he's in Dr. Harrison's house. He's wearing the same clothes in the house as he's wearing in the car. Now, it's not his fault that in 1978 things were done very differently. That, like everything else in life, things have moved on, things have improved. But what it does do is to call into question every aspect of the scene examination, of the potential for contamination, and calls into question the results after a multitude of moving, unpacking, repacking, testing, repacking, unpacking that's gone on over the years between 1978 and now. Mr. Jensen was very keen to hypothesise about things, which is not the task of a scientist. Paint was another of his expertise areas. Indistinguishable. He went on to tell you he was at that time 18 months into the job. And another technique may have shown a difference, that there was no chemistry done. What nobody told you was how many vehicles of that colour were on the road in 1978. British Leyland Green, I think it would be called. No evidence about that. He had no knowledge, you have no knowledge. What you are left with in relation to that is there is one microscopical fragment which, according to Eric Jensen, was indistinguishable from the sample taken from Dr. Harrison's car. 2 days after, on the Crown case, the owner of the car has been in that house. And a few days after, 3 or 4 days after, Brenda Page has been in the car, according to Dr. Harrison. We then had the watch, or the watch strap. In my submission, the watch strap is either a total red herring or just simply makes no sense at all. The Crown theory, based on who knows what, is that Dr. Harrison's watch was damaged in the course of the attack. Now, there was evidence, I think, of a damaged watch, which was Brenda Page's watch. It was a lady's watch. No evidence of any other watch there. So, what the Crown theory seems to be in relation to the watch strap is that Dr. Harrison manages to collect the damaged watch, remove any fragments of the damaged watch that might exist, get rid of the murder weapon, get rid, presumably, of all the clothes he was wearing at the time, successfully clean his car and his house of any remnants of blood, but keeps the watch strap. And his method of getting rid of the watch strap is to what? Set a fire in the middle of July? You would have thought putting it in a bin, down a drain, whatever. Doing anything with it, putting it where you put the murder weapon might be the answer. And then, when he goes to Edinburgh and buys another watch, in the course of doing so, patiently stands there in the shop and writes out the guarantee in front of the shopkeeper. Doesn't sound awfully like somebody trying to cover their tracks in relation to something that had just happened the day before.
Missile after missile, his words were diminishing every bit of evidence. Hours of spoken testimony just dismissed.
Thomas Gorman, police officer. He's one of half a dozen or more police officers who attend to arrest a 79-year-old man at 7:55 in the morning, putting in his door. He's then kept in a cell for hours until interviewed, where, as you know, he answers questions. You then had the opportunity to watch the ridiculous scenario of Thomas Gorman climbing through some kind of setup in relation to the window. A setup totally different, you may think, from the situation faced by whoever climbed in to the property in Allen Street. They have a built-in ledge for Mr. Gorman to stand on. They have nothing at the sides of the window so he can hang on to it as he climbs up there. The window's already open. Yet, it takes him 30 minutes, several attempts, by a 40-year-old fit police officer. Not quite the same, perhaps, as a 37-year-old, as he would have been at the time, scientist. I don't suppose we know, but I doubt Dr. Harrison was down the gym that morning. It is, in my submission, ladies and gentlemen, a pointless, ludicrous, irrelevant piece of evidence which you can put alongside the window pane removal, the poisoned bread, the talk of suicide, etc., all of which really fits into the prosecution plan of if you throw enough dirt at something, then some of it might stick.
His next target, the operation set up by the police to reinvestigate the case.
Operation Clarity was never an operation to establish the truth. Operation Clarity was an operation designed to try and convict Christopher Harrison. You heard a bit about DNA evidence. The height of it, as in at its best for the Crown, it is that they found DNA which matched that of Dr. Harrison. Cannot say how long it had been there. Days, weeks, or even longer. And I think it was Mr. Gibb who pointed out you can recover DNA after thousands of years. What is the Crown case in relation to the finding of DNA? There is no evidence at all before you of any sexual attack by Christopher Harrison or Brenda Page. There is no libel, i.e. there's nothing in the charge at all involving that. There is no evidence of sexual intercourse having taken place. What do you learn, or what did you learn about the findings? Well, you learned that AP can be present without sperm, and that sperm can be present without AP. The Learned Advocate Deputy, at one point in a question to, I think it was Mr. Gibb, said, is it the case that the only detectable DNA you found was that of either Brenda Page or Christopher Harrison? And he was corrected by Mr. Gibb, who said, interpretable. There was other detectable DNA which we couldn't interpret. And indeed, contrary to what the Learned Advocate Deputy said to you in his address this morning, there was at least one piece of evidence where they were able to detect at least three people's DNA. So that has to include AN other, even if they were Brenda Page and Christopher Harrison, about which there is no evidence. But how could they interpret the DNA as being anyone else's? There is no evidence to suggest they had a control sample from any other individual who Brenda Page had been to any extent involved. The only interpretation they could make is either it's Brenda Page, it's Christopher Harrison, or it's neither. They couldn't go on to say who else's it might be, because they had nobody else's to test. One of the areas they talked about, I think it was 1 in 220 or something of that nature. It was a figure in any event, which meant that even in the United Kingdom there would be 30,000 people who would have those parts of the DNA in their makeup.
Once again, his words being used to dismiss the forensic evidence with the same effort as batting away a fly, conveniently ignoring Christopher Ganicliffe's evidence. And he doesn't even mention his client's explanation of Brenda having in excess of 50 sheets, and if she used one set per fortnight, then it may just so happen, after 2 years, she uses a set which has his sperm on it.
That's why I say Operation Clarity was not there to establish the truth or to seek out who the perpetrator might be. Operation Clarity was designed to point the finger at Christopher Harrison. There's no evidence to suggest at all that they had DNA samples from any of the people mentioned in the joint minute. Andrew Gibb, when talking about the semen stains and AP in particular, said in a decent wash cycle you would expect it to be removed. In my submission, you have no evidence at all about how well, how badly, how often she washed her bedding, whether she had a washing machine. The Advocate Deputy asked questions regularly about her cleanliness, but none of it was about her laundry habits.
Again, he's missed out forensic scientist Christopher Ganicliffe's appraisal of the sheets. In his opinion, they were regularly laundered from his own inspection with his eyes and nose.
You already know that sperm can subsist even after washing. So if the bed linen was washed, who knows how often? Sperm could exist. The more often you wash it, the less likelihood there is. But you know it can exist. You know about Brenda Page's mother's bed linen situation, not just from the accused, but from her sister.
Rita Ling did not say Brenda had an excess of 50 sets of bedding. Why on earth would a woman with no children and recently separated insist on taking 50 sheets to a tiny flat?
So, if you had sperm already present and AP, acid phosphatate, arising from another source, and you heard the evidence about other sources that it could come from, including vaginal secretions, then once you accept that that's a theoretical possibility, it all then becomes a matter of interpretation. The other thing about this aspect of the evidence is, whatever this case may have shown, and whatever impression you may have formed of Dr. Harrison, I don't imagine for a second that you will have formed the impression that he's an idiot. I think you're likely to have formed the impression that he's an intelligent man. It would be the easiest explanation in the world for Dr. Harrison to have said, having heard the evidence, yes, on the 12th of July, when I went in there and we had the haircut, the reason I was in there for 2 hours is we had sex. We were getting on fine. We'd been to Vienna. She'd taken me to that party. We had a bit of a blip about the graduation, but this was kind of a make-up situation and we had sex. The easiest explanation in the world. That would have rendered that piece of evidence completely neutral. Completely neutral. He doesn't say that. He says, I never had sex with her at that address in Allen Street. Now, why would an intelligent man, staring at that obvious explanation in the face, say that? And the answer is, because it's true.
Or because he'd been adamant in the police interview that they had not had sex since their separation in 1976, 2 years before the murder. And he couldn't change his story now.
DNA, of course, remains important in this case, and not just for the Crown. Linda Advocate Depute said to you at one point about the fact that Chris Gannacliffe told you that, well, you don't necessarily become contaminated with blood if you're the assailant. Well, as a theoretical position, that's fine. So what? Because the one thing you know is it doesn't apply here. Because Brenda Page's assailant was contaminated with blood. And you know that. I mean, let's take the common sense approach, first of all. You saw the amount of blood that was within that room and on that bed. The idea that somebody could carry out such an assault, more than 20 blows, in close proximity and not get blood on them, as a common sense point, just is simply nonsense. But we don't have to worry about the common sense point, because you know there is blood on the door handle of that room, in the sense of a smear of blood. Now, it wasn't Brenda Page that put it there. You know there is blood on a light switch in the bathroom. That wasn't Brenda Page either. There's blood on the inner door handle of the front door and on the outer jamb of the front door. The assailant had blood on their hands, as you would expect, when they left that property. If it was Christopher Harrison, he apparently succeeds in getting out of the house, into his car, out of his car, into his own house, without leaving the singlest minute trace of blood. He also managed to dispose of a bloody weapon.
A forensically aware scientist trying to get away with murder would not have set foot out of the flat in bloodied clothes or in his car or home. The only reason for going into the bathroom after killing Brenda would be to clean up. Evidence was not led on this in court, but forensics did find blood in the sink and drain. And let's not forget the absence of any bloody fingerprints, which must point heavily to gloves being worn.
Now, you'll remember the evidence perhaps about the shape of something peculiar on the bed or on the underside of the sheet, as if something had been laid there which already had blood on it, and then the sheet for some reason put back over. But that item, whatever it was, kind of common sense would suggest it was the murder weapon. Covered in blood, presumably taken into the car. Now, in re-examination, I think it was, the learned advocate deputy said, well, you wouldn't necessarily get blood in the car if you wrapped the weapon in a sheet. I'm sure that's true, but what's the evidence that anybody wrapped it in a sheet? Well, where did the sheet come from? He asked about gloves, if you had gloves on. But the blood's there. The blood is present on everything that the assailant has touched. When they carry out the tests on every potential forensic trace between Brenda Page and Christopher Harrison, they find not a trace of Brenda Page on Christopher Harrison. Her hair, DNA, skin, blood, right down to his fingernails. There is blood on his fingernails as it happens, but it's his. Equally, not a trace of him. Hair, skin, blood on her, DNA, nothing on the point of entry. Nothing in the wardrobe that Eric Jensen speculatively suggested he was somehow or other hiding in. And it probably brings me to another point. What is the Crown theory? Because what you know is, whenever Brenda Page got back to the house, she got back to the house, undressed, did whatever she did in the evening, and got into her nightdress. Where is Dr. Harrison all this time? Then what is supposed to have happened? If, as the Crown suggest, Christopher Harrison ejaculated in that room, what happened? How did it all come about? Where was he hiding the weapon at the time? It's just none of it makes sense. The reason we have you, the reason we put you through this, is because you're the people we believe make the system work. You all presumably have very, very different lives. Chances are you've never met before. You all have common sense that's been built up over the years in the different things that you do. And we bring you together because your collective common sense is deemed to be better than a single judge sitting alone. And when you look at this case, the Crown theory, such as it is, just doesn't make sense.
Mr. McConaughey says that a lot. It doesn't make sense. I wonder if he was attempting to deploy the same technique he accused Brenda of. Say it enough times, and people will believe you. Except in Brenda's case, she feared she'd be murdered, and she was. So does that mean his theory is that, in the years prior to her death, she had been vindictively lying about her shy husband, so she could posthumously frame him, on the off chance someone else murdered her? That, in my opinion, is what doesn't make sense. And if you think I'm being unfair, well, Mr. McConaughey is about to even things up with a complete character assassination of Dr. Brenda Page, the 32-year-old woman who was brutally murdered.
Brenda Page planted a lot of seeds with her colleagues in particular. But when you look at the real evidence, in my submission, you can see that they fly in the face of the truth. Needing to find a ground for the divorce she decided she wanted, and the life, it seems, within a few months she wanted to lead, she told her story with virtually no independent support for it whatsoever. You set aside what she said and look at what she did, and the two things just don't match. Picnics in the garden, invitations for dinner with bottles of wine, trip to Vienna, party invitation after she splits from Mr. Narrow, the journey to the garage, the invitation to the house on the 12th of July. Now, every one of those things comes from the evidence of people other than the accused, except for the garage. Why, if she was so afraid, so terrified, so desperate that she had to have an interdict protecting her from this evil and violent man, did all those things take place? In my submission, the production 64 confirms, when you look at it, that it is in fact all a charade. Production 64 was the letter that Brenda Page wrote to Dr. Christopher Harrison. Now, this is supposed to be a woman who is terrified. This is a woman who has been writing letters about, if I end up dead, make sure I get a good post-mortem. We can't date the letter precisely, but we know it is post-graduation and relatively close to the time of her death. You do nothing but hurt me, let me down, and make a fool of me. Now, even stopping there, how does that make sense? You're not getting the chance to do it anymore. I don't have to put up with that kind of mental torture or any ridicule. I don't wish to see you ever again. If you do bother me by phone or by calling or by any other kit-type invention, I will call on the interdict at once. And that's why I said to you much earlier on that the interdict was a stick to beat him with. But the rest of the letter, You could have made it possible for me to attend your graduation and put on an after celebration which I had planned as a surprise. You could easily have dealt with the complications if you had really wanted me there. I encouraged all these things so as not to influence you in any way, so that you could make up your own mind. Now, are these the words of somebody who wants nothing to do with Christopher Harrison? Are these the words of somebody who wants him out of her life? Are these the words of somebody who is terrified of her ex-husband? I suggest they're not. They are words which make it abundantly clear that she was the one who was looking to be at his graduation. She was the one who had planned some celebration for him. She goes on, "Is winning your legal battle more important than getting me back?" Now, the Crown would have you accept or have you believe that Christopher Harrison couldn't bear to see her with anybody else. He was the rejected man and therefore he violently attacked her. Does this letter not, in fact, tell you almost the complete opposite? "To take my key away and get June in to look after the animals was the most disgusting flaunting of a sexual bonanza in front of my staff that you could have thought up. They all knew I had planned going to your graduation and are laughing themselves silly now." It's a woman who is feeling scorned by not getting to his graduation. It's difficult, perhaps, to understand the flaunting of a sexual bonanza, but what it does say is that she is one who is considering he's making a fool out of her with her colleagues. I don't want to gloss over anything in case you think it's important. It goes on, "I will write to Edwards withdrawing my connection with your section of the teaching so that we will not be forced together over that. My section is well away from yours in the second term. In spite of what you constantly accuse, I am no prostitute except with you, and that with an original slant of me paying you. I had thought I had put up enough preventative measures against being used, but I was wrong again. Well, get on with the lies and storytelling." Well, who's the one who's been telling the lies, telling the stories? "I want no part of the dishonesty with which you surround your life. Forgive my stupidity. I had thought that maybe things would change for us." What's the us? According to everything she's telling everybody, there's certainly no us. What's the change? "Just get out of my life and stay out." How, in my submission, ladies and gentlemen, can that be interpreted in any other way? She was very much, at that point in time, close to her death, after him, rather than the other way about.
I'll offer another interpretation, and one that A.D. Alec Prentice hinted at. Abusive relationships are complex, and I don't mean just physical abuse. Coercive control erodes the victim. It's a roller coaster of highs and lows, and one thing that is proven through research is it takes roughly 7 attempts before the victim will truly end the relationship. That's not necessarily the action of moving out. It's the final "it's over," which is the most dangerous time. The abuser has finally lost control. The end of this letter sounded like Brenda's final straw. And then the phone call to her friend on the evening she was killed saying she had rejected another attempt by Kit. Was that Kit's final straw?
The death of Brenda Page was a real tragedy, a word that is often overused in these courts. Do not, ladies and gentlemen, compound that tragedy by convicting Dr. Christopher Harrison on this hodgepodge of gossip, storytelling, innuendo, and what now would probably be called fake news. In due course, this case passes to you. And as I've already said to you, don't be in any doubt, you are the most important people in this room. You decide what the evidence is. At various points in my address, as I have to, I've referred to the evidence. But if you think I've got it wrong, you go by your recollection, not mine. But you decide what the evidence is. You decide what parts of it you accept as credible and or reliable. You decide what inferences, if any, you're prepared to make and where it takes you. Or more importantly, perhaps, where it takes the Crown. Now, obviously, that gives you incredible power in relation to this matter. And of course, as with everything else, such power brings great responsibility. And what I ask you to do is to scrutinise the evidence with great care. When you're considering this in the privacy of your room, first of all, you have to be prepared to have your say. Although you're a collective, each one of you is entitled to your say in relation to the matter. And you have to be prepared to say something that sometimes doesn't come easy to us, which is, I don't know. At the end of the day, that's really what an acquittal is. I've listened, I've considered the evidence, I've thought about it all, and I just don't know. But whether, ladies and gentlemen, you decide this evidence is wholly unconvincing, deeply unsatisfying, or whether you just don't know, the just result here is a verdict that acquits Dr. Harrison.
It was painful to end on this point. Ask anyone if they'd bet on someone's life on an event they were not witness to. They'd wobble. It's confusing to be told if you're not sure, rather than reasonable doubt. One thing there was no doubt about, there was a new uneasiness in the courtroom. As infuriating as it was to listen to parts of his speech, he had done a good job. In the next episode of The Storyteller Naked Villainy, doubts creep in. Could the jury choose Scotland's unique, controversial third verdict?
I woke up this morning and I thought, I curse that not proven verdict in Scotland, just in case that's used as a cop-out.
Tensions rise after hours of waiting.
His Majesty's Advocate against Christopher Harrison in court number one. This is a verdict.
And the 45-year road to justice is over.
Have you agreed upon a verdict?
We have.
If you've enjoyed this episode, please rate and review, as it makes a huge difference to guiding people to hearing this important story. This is an entirely independent production and your support is greatly appreciated. And if you want to hear exclusive interviews, longer episodes and insights, please head to the Patreon. The link is in the show notes. Thank you again for listening. This is a piece of history and you are for the first time in this format witnessing justice being done.